the most important meal of the day, second breakfast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to another Second Breakfast podcast. I'm Andy Roth alongside Phil Duvall. Say hi, Phil.
Hi, everybody.
Phil, do you remember? I mean, thankfully this wasn't.
Sigh.
Oh, I hate you. Do you remember early on when I would introduce each podcast and I couldn't get out the word Second Breakfast Podcast?
You're so much more of a pro now.
I have more experience saying the words.
True.
I try to say breakfast like 20 times a day. Just
breakfast, 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 second right. breakfast, breakfast, breakfast.
Red leather, yellow leather. Yes.
So, toy boat, toy boat, toy boat, toy boat, toy boat.
Yes. It's Friday, and that fact has made us both a little goofy. Or at least me. I can't speak for you, Phil.
Mailbag!
Well done. Well done.
Thank
there.
You. Thank well you. Thank you.
The mailbag foghorn symbolizes the boat carrying all of your letters to Second Breakfast Island, where we research and ponder and come up with our incredibly studied and considered answers.
Don't you want to get breakfast on Second Breakfast Island? All right.
I like it.
I do not have the questions today. You have the – I've seen the questions. Yes. I have knowledge. Do you remember when we used to not actually – I wouldn't – for some reason you wouldn't let me hear the questions and then
– Whoa, whoa, whoa. This is not like I'm going to be cruel to you. We were both like, let's see if this works.
No, I know. But we actually had to talk about it. We were like, do we want to switch it up so that I actually have knowledge of the questions? Mm-hmm. Like we had to actually have that conversation.
Right.
What's funny, guys, about doing a podcast is the stuff you guys don't care about at all are the things that Andy and I think a lot about. Like,
agonize over.
Oh, God, what if we did it? Well, oh, no. Like we joke a lot about, like, well, we don't really know what we're doing on Tuesdays. We joke about it, but when we're not on the air, we're like, what's happening on Tuesday?
And what's important to remember is it is roughly scientifically a schmillion times better now than it was at the beginning. We are grizzled veterans compared to what we were at the beginning. Oh
there
man.
It there it is.
Ugh.
There it is.
All right. Well, I don't have a piece of paper to go to make the sound, but oh, are you gonna
I hope he didn't need those papers. I'm at a friend's house. I hope that works out. So, all right.
okay. Question number one.
Oh, here we go.
From Damon.
Hello, Damon.
Good friend of the podcast, Damon.
Damon.
Well done there. What are some comedic scenes involving exactly two actors that you consider to be perfect? Actors here is unisex. I didn't think you were being sexist, Damon. The rest of the movie need not be perfect or even great. The movie doesn't even have to be a comedy.
I
love that last sentence, so I tried really hard.
And to come up with one that wasn't a comedy?
Yeah, but one that's both not a comedy and has two actors in a scene that is funny to the point of being perfect. Or perfect and funny, I guess I should say. I couldn't come up with anything, did you?
I came up with a lot of things. Okay, here's the deal. I came up with a lot of answers.
Okay.
I came up with, and this is an interesting thing, and I overthought this. I came up with a lot of answers for television. And I realized that television has some great, great, like, one-on-one,
right.
Way more than movies do.
Sure. Two-handers. Two-handers.
Is that what they're called?
I believe so.
There's one that I watch over and over again from Deadwood where Al Swearengen, who's the barkeep, is having a conversation with Merrick, who is the owner of the Newtontown newspaper, who's played by former Ed Rooney, Jeff Jones.
Nice.
And Jeff Jones is complaining about someone ruining his coming in and tearing down his store, and Swearengen's like, what are you scared of? You know? And like, and he basically, what are you scared of? And are you scared of getting hurt? And he's like, yeah, I'm scared of getting hurt. And he slaps him in the face. And he's like, you still alive? And then, but that whole thing is just phenomenal. You have to watch that. So Deadwood is filled with things like that. I think the ultimate when it comes to television actually is Curb Your Enthusiasm. And it's Larry David and whoever Larry David is talking to. They did this. Curb Your Enthusiasm is based on two people sitting in a room. Every episode is at least one or two straight up showdowns between Larry David and just someone who doesn't like Larry David. I mean, and he just, this is a guy who was famous as a stand-up comedian for when people didn't like his jokes, be like, you guys are idiots, that was a good joke. Awesome. Like, openly, would be like, what's wrong with you people? Like, not, these are the jokes, folks, but like, you know, a better audience would get this stuff.
Nice.
Openly combative when people didn't like his jokes.
You know?
And that speaks a lot to the way he does his comedy. Sure. Or his show.
Can I jump in here real quick? Because I just came up with an answer for the unicorn, right? For the non-comedy that has a perfect and funny scene with two characters.
Please.
Pick a scene from, not any scene involving these two people, but pick a scene with Bryan Cranston and Aaron Paul in Breaking Bad.
Well said.
You know?
Yeah. Yep.
Because there are perfect. Even in the last
season. Even when they're terrifying and sad or whatever, they're funny.
Yes.
I agree. I'm with you. That's a great call.
Yes, science.
When it comes to movies, I think the brass ring has got to be Princess Bride.
Nice.
Because Wesley has one with Andre the Giant, one with Inigo Montoya, and one with Vizzini.
So well
Although
said.
The one with Vizzini, technically Robin Wright is there, but she literally doesn't speak at all.
I'm okay with that.
Okay.
I'm okay with that as an
and
answer.
Those three are sort of the templates of just like perfect one-on-one conversations. There are several in the movie Midnight Run between De Niro and Charles Grodin.
Yes.
There's also other ones that there's threesomes with Marvin, the other bounty hunter. But
sure.
But there's several conversations. There's one where they're on a train together. They're hoboing a train, and De Niro's giving Grodin the silent treatment, and Grodin starts doing an impression of De Niro, like, and he gets him to laugh even though he hates him, and it's just that movie's priceless. That movie's priceless. That movie also has a scene. I get teary-eyed every time I think about it. It's a comedy that has one of the best dramatic one-on-one scenes, which is him and his daughter that he hasn't seen in 10 years. I'm getting goosebumps thinking about it. I don't even want to.
Here's the deal, Phil. I think I don't know this, but I think you're going to back me up when I say this to our audience. However much you like Midnight Run, it isn't enough. It's just
It grows in my esteem as time goes by, and I liked it to begin with.
Right,
but like,
that's right.
It keeps getting better. Right.
I saw it as a kid, and I liked it, and I see it as an adult now, and it's sublime.
There is a great comic scene in one of my favorite underrated movies called A Perfect World.
Nice.
Between Kevin Costner, who's an ex-con, and he kidnaps this kid. He and this other convict, I think they kidnap the kid. But long story short, it's just him and the other kid. And there's a scene in the movie where – so what happens is the other convict besides – they're not ex-cons. They're fugitives. That's what it is. The other fugitive, they kidnap this little boy. His name's Philip, actually.
Awesome.
And the other fugitive starts to try to do bad things to the little boy.
Okay.
And Kevin Costner catches him and kills him. And so – protects the little boy, sure. And then the little boy and him run off, and he basically then it becomes like a road trip movie with a convict and this little boy, mm-hmm. And the little boy has this moment where I can't quote it because it's just not appropriate, but the little boy's basically like, he said this about me, and he says and Kevin Costner's like, well you know, whatever he said isn't true, and there's just this great bonding moment, but it's done in a really funny way, and I don't want to ruin it. Everybody should see A Perfect World, and it's a drama with a great comic scene between these two people. And it's just the two of them in the car together, and it's a little boy and Kevin Costner. I know I had another movie. Oh, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Steve Martin and John Candy. Those aren't pillows.
Did you see the Bears game?
Yeah. And there's several scenes in that movie, the two of them. But it's just they carry that movie. I mean, it's their movie. It's just amazing.
And the movie is perfect, so by definition.
And
any scene in it is perfect.
And the scene between Steve Martin and Edie McClurg in that movie.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
That's a huge one.
Oh.
I also want to give...
Literally, we couldn't say three consecutive words from that scene.
Yep.
Oh, it's so good.
No. So many scenes, or so many little moments between Shirley MacLaine and Jack Lemmon in the apartment, especially the final scene.
Oh, yeah.
And then I also want to give a special shout out to Jimmy Stewart and Cary Grant in Philadelphia Story in the C.K. Dexter Haven drunken Jimmy Stewart scene.
Yes.
Which is an amazing scene and won Jimmy Stewart the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor.
Nicely done.
And then Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn together in, what's the one with the cheetah? Bringing Up Baby.
Bringing Up Baby.
There are so many moments. She is stellar in that movie. Katharine Hepburn is just, I mean, she's Katharine Hepburn, I get it. But I think the thing about Katharine Hepburn is I always thought of her as sort of graceful.
Right.
And she plays this total goofball, just a ridiculous human being. I mean, you can see where Zooey Deschanel comes from when you watch Bringing Up Baby.
Yes. I mean,
it's screwball humor.
Yes. With Katharine Hepburn, I think probably the first two movies, I don't know about this, but I think the first two movies I saw with her in it were The African Queen, where she is regal. I mean, she has that sort of air about her.
Yep.
And The Lion in Winter, where she plays the queen.
Right.
And she's amazing.
So going backwards, and then I saw her in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. So going backwards and seeing her play this just flighty, goofball, mile a minute, spoiled brat. It is amazing. I mean, it's just a revelation. Yeah. It really is. She's a revelation.
That's the word I was thinking of. And it's so interesting because you think of, it usually goes the other way, right? Like, or if not, when you watch their later stuff, it's the revelation. It's the first time you see them, it's a revelation. With Hepburn, there's a revelation the first time you see her. And then when you see her early stuff.
Right.
Oh,
right.
Such a fan. Well done.
Those are my answers for now.
I love it. I love it. My first one, well, actually, speaking of Edie McClurg, I want to give you my honorable mention because this is not one that I think counts. Alan Ruck and Matthew Broderick in the talk. Why'd you kick me? Talk!
Why'd you kick me?
And the reason I don't think it counts is even though they're alone in the kitchen.
We know he's on the phone with Rooney.
And Rooney, Jeffrey Jones and Edie McClurg are such an integral part of that scene. You know what I mean?
It's almost like you have two separate scenes that are like, this is amazing by itself. This is amazing by itself. The timing of that Craig call scene is impeccable.
Impeccable. Absolutely.
And the chemistry between Alan Ruck and Matthew Broderick is just out of control.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I am... Alan Ruck is up there on my list of like, man, I wish he had a, I'm not even saying better career, but like
bigger.
A different, yeah, bigger, bigger. And different career than he had. I love him in everything I see him in. A couple of movies that I think you could pick any scene from, or any scene with two people, Defending Your Life, take your pick with any one of several scenes between Albert Brooks and Meryl Streep, and especially Albert Brooks. And Rip Torn.
You just reminded me of something, but go ahead. Go ahead.
I don't want to really talk about it that much.
Okay. I was just going to say Albert Brooks and Debbie Reynolds in Mother. There's several scenes. There's a scene in the kitchen where there's several of them. There's great moments, but she's trying to like, he opens the fridge and she's divided up all the food because he's a vegetarian and she basically moved a whole, like, so that he could have half the fridge and she could have half the fridge.
Right.
And she like made a big separating line and put like tape down it so that like he wouldn't get confused and accidentally put his vegetarian food near hers. And he looks and he goes, it's like it happened one night for food. And then there's like this whole thing where she gives him this sherbet that's like this bargain sherbet that's like a year old. And he's like, it tastes like mud. Like there's just the whole scene in the kitchen is amazing. It's just, and there's just, and I think the thing I love about that movie in that scene specifically does it is, it's not a perfect movie, actually, that movie, but the chemistry between them and the way that it's imperfect reminds me of Mothers and Sons.
Sure.
Like, it's imperfect because Mothers and Sons just, it's just...
I totally forgot that line. It's like it happened one night for food. That is amazing.
Great
and,
line.
And it's especially amazing if you're a total movie dork, which, thankfully, both of us are.
There's a phone somewhere ringing. Could be my phone. Oh, well.
Life's an adventure.
Can you hear it from where you are? Is it bothersome? Should I go? No, it'll stop eventually.
Yeah, it'll stop eventually. Or maybe it will never stop. Another movie.
My phone's on silent, so when it's ringing off the hook from all the people calling.
Another movie you could pick any one of several scenes from, and this is the closest one to not being a comedy.
Okay.
Bull Durham. You know, I mean, what's interesting is you've got the three central characters, Tim Robbins, Susan Sarandon, and Kevin Costner, and they're not really in all that many scenes together all at once, but there are a ton of scenes where it's just two sides of the triangle. Every side of the triangle. And I mean the scene where he is teaching him cliches, the scene where they're making love and she's like, would you rather me be making love to him using your name or you using his name? It's perfect. It's perfect.
Yeah. Can we just do a Kevin Costner run here for a second?
Yeah.
Cause him and Rene Russo in Tin Cup, when courting her is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically when she makes him put all the goofy gadgets on, or she comes over and he's got all the goofy gadgets on.
Right.
It's just that chemistry. And then here's another one, and not a comedy. Field of Dreams, not a comedy. The moment when Amy Madigan and him are talking and they realize they've had the same dream at the same time.
Right.
I mean, that's pure perfect comic timing. That it's exhilarating and it makes you feel like this impossible thing is possible, and it totally works.
Yeah. I wouldn't call this an entire scene, although the entire scene is good, but there's that lovely little moment after he's researching Terrence Mann and they're getting in the car and he's like, you know what his first love was? And she's like, some kind of team sport.
They're a great couple in that movie, man.
They're my sneaky. They're my pick for sneaky best marriage in movie history. So I have two more.
Good.
First, probably the best cinematic, seen cinematically speaking, and also funny and also perfect. The "I Love You" scene from Annie
Thank
Hall.
You. I wanted to talk about that.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Say more.
It is, first off, to set the scene, he's walking with his girlfriend. They haven't been together very long. It's Woody Allen, Diane Keaton. And they're talking about the relationship and how their feelings are growing. And she's like, I like you. I like you a lot. I like you a lot. And she's babbling because that's what she does. She babbles. And he's like, do you love me? And she's like, I do. I love you. I love you. And he's like, oh, that's great. And she's like, do you love me? And she's like, and he goes, Are you kidding? I love you. I love you. I love you. I have to make
love. I love you.
Love. Two F's. He says. And in addition to that, it's a very dark scene. The light. They are in shadow, not completely obscured, but mostly. And it gives it this sort of These are lovers, and we are giving them a little privacy, but they are still letting us in. And it's on the water in New York, and it's gorgeous because it's Woody Allen in the 70s, and it's just...
I'm glad you brought up that movie. I was thinking about that movie as well, and I was thinking about that specific scene.
Mm-hmm.
And it reminded me also of Harry and Sally when they're doing the impressions, and he finally asks her out, but she doesn't realize he's asking her out.
That's it. That's
Wait, there is too much pepper in my poppycosh.
That is the scene from that movie.
But I would be proud to partake in your pecan pie.
Pecan pie.
And I thought about both those movies, and then I forgot them until you said them. But I thought about them both for a very specific reason, which is that the reason, and I'm just like, oh, Annie Hall and When Harry Met Sally, we get it. But the reason that we talk about these two movies, for example, is that when you watch a lot of romantic comedies today. It's like, okay, here's an example, right? What's that movie? It's called What's Your Number? And it's Anna Faris Chris Evans.
Yep.
It's Chris Evans, right?
Yeah, yes, I think so. Yes.
So it's some ridiculously gorgeous woman and some ridiculously gorgeous man.
Right. Spending 90 minutes trying to find reasons why they shouldn't have a lot of really, really gorgeous babies.
Right, exactly.
And that's it.
And that is a lot of romantic comedies these days. Actually, that's basically all of them.
Yeah, I agree.
It's just... hot woman and hot man being hot near each other and us going, right, okay, be hot.
I don't know. No Strings Attached was a... I don't even remember who was in that movie. Was that Natalie
Well, there
Portman
was those two... There was Friends with Benefits and No Strings Attached. And they came out like they were the same movie.
Right. It was like Dante's Peak and Volcano.
Yeah, so one of them was Natalie Portman and Ashton Kutcher. That's gorgeous and gorgeous. And then was Ryan Seacrest and Mila Kunis.
Justin Timberlake.
Stop. Whatever.
Right, yes. Yeah. Agreed.
So anyways... Who did I say instead of me? It doesn't matter.
Ryan Seacrest. That's amazing.
Which is the same thing as Justin Timberlake as far as I'm concerned. I don't care what people say about Justin Timberlake. Oh, he's so talented. He's so amazing. He is Ryan Seacrest. The two of them are the exact same person to me. So anyways.
I very briefly, very quickly.
People will be so offended by that.
So a friend of mine, a very good friend of mine, she was the maitre d' at Balthazar when I was the breakfast manager, and her husband was the office assistant. So we were all in the building together. It was great. Ryan Seacrest came in to Balthazar at one point, and as close to verbatim as I can get, this was her reaction. She was like, "He is a tiny person, perfectly proportioned, tiny man. I will never forget that.
That's amazing.
Carrie.
That's why he tries so hard.
Yes. Carrie. That's why he tries so hard. That's it.
So Woody Allen, not a conventionally attractive man.
Right.
There are people who find him attractive, but he's not conventionally attractive.
Agreed.
And frankly, Diane Keaton, she's pretty, but she's not like,
right.
She's not like, it's not Derek. It's not Bo Derek in the
70s. Right.
Or even Muriel Hemingway. I mean, it's like, it's, and the, that right. movie, and, Annie Hall, that movie rests on their chemistry. I mean, the whole movie, it hinges on that working.
Yes.
And that it feels so real to see these just two people that are incredibly gifted, incredibly entertaining actors just being wonderful together. And I would say the same thing about When Harry Met Sally. Meg Ryan is cute. Meg Ryan's never been she's beautiful even, but she's beautiful on the cute side. She's not the siren.
She's not beautiful in the Hollywood way.
Right, but she's beautiful.
Oh, agreed.
Billy Crystal. whatever. He's not, again, he's a fine guy, but it's not, you're not like, he's not a heartthrob Billy Crystal.
It's true.
And it is a romantic, like, it just, because you buy the relationship and you care.
That's right.
And it's just funny. I mean, the two of them together, you're right. That scene and the scene right before they first make love, Harry and Sally, when she's throwing the Kleenexes down and crying, and he's picking them up and picking them up, and she's throwing them down, and I'm going to be 40.
When?
Someday. But it's out there.
In 8 years. It's out there. It's not the same for men. Charlie Chaplin had babies when he was in his 70s. Yeah, but he was told to pick them up. And she laughs and it turns into a sob and I die. I die.
Oh, man. Yeah, so I mean, I think we gave too many. It's almost like, Damon, good question. I think we had way too many answers.
Here's the deal. I have one more and it might be my number one. We don't have to talk about it long.
Okay.
It is my pick probably for funniest scene in movie history. Gene Wilder and Peter Boyle putting on the Ritz in Young Frankenstein. And I mean,
there's a bunch of other people there.
There are a bunch of other people there, but I mean, they're not in the shot, you know.
Okay. Fair enough.
It's for the same reason that I kicked out the Ferris Bueller's Day Off scene. I feel like I can, and it's like the Princess Bride scene that you said, you know, like, or the one with Vizzini. it is comedies get less funny the more you watch them. Action movies get less exciting the more you watch them, except for the truly shining examples of the genre. I cannot imagine a scenario where I will not, where my sides will not hurt after watching that scene.
That's funny because I love that scene, but there's them digging the grave out. Could be worse, could be raining.
Yes.
And then the other thing that I love is in that movie, well, the put the candle back scene.
Put the candle back.
You can actually see his lips. It's just perfect. It's so perfect. And then the other scene from that movie that I love is the one with Gene Hackman. Wait, I was going to make espresso.
That is Peter Boyle in that movie, man.
I'm so glad. He plays a crazy person in Dream Team who thinks he's Jesus Christ and walks around naked drinking communion wine, and it is amazing. Awesome. But it's a movie that it's a trifle of a movie that never really made a big deal. But I'm really glad that he got a run, like on Everybody Loves Raymond. I'm glad that he. So I was in a bathroom with him once in LAX. We passed each other in the men's room at LAX once.
How was that?
Peter Boyle there.
Nice.
Yeah.
Wow. In a bathroom with Peter Boyle. I think that's the cherry on top of this question Sunday.
I think we had better move on then.
Right? I can't top that. I don't think you can either. Next question from, much like Damon, excellent friend of the podcast, Mike. Hello, Mike. I've heard Phil say, off the podcast, that he does not care to watch sad movies, or perhaps it was bleak movies. Can you ask him to expand on this? The reason I ask is because I heard him say that he was a fan of The Mist, and that had about as bleak an ending as you can have. Before you go, Phil, Mike, I'm just going to assume that the part where you said, can you ask him and Andy to expand on that was lost in the mail. So, there you go, you jerk. Phil, talk to me.
Yes. Did you have something to ask me?
Expand on this.
Oh, sure. Okay.
Nice.
Okay, a couple things. I don't like sad movies or movies that end sadly or grimly. And I don't like them.
Sure.
And I'll talk about that. I don't like plays. I don't like stories. I'll talk about that. It could just be because I'm a wuss, but I think there's more to it. I appreciated The Mist as a horror film.
Mm-hmm.
And I was mostly, by the way, Mike, I was mostly just impressed that I sat through it because this was about 3 years ago. And I don't know why I rented it,
nice.
But I did.
Sure.
I think it was because Frank Darabont did it and I wanted to give it a shot.
Mm-hmm.
It scared me.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of problems with the way religious people are portrayed in that movie. Not that there aren't religious people like that, because there are, but I'm a little kind of like Stephen King Tim Burton does this too. They kind of, there's like a go-to, like, let's just make religious people bad. And I'm like,
yes.
Like, I mean, just, I'm a religious person. So for me, I'm like, I'm a Christian who is a fan of you guys. Like, is this the only way? But whatever. Two things I want to say about the end of The Mist.
Mm.
One, as I've been told, that ending is very controversial because it's not the way the story ends that Stephen King wrote.
That's right.
It ends with them driving off into the mist, and that's the end. It's this sort of hopefulness or this sort of unknowing.
Yeah.
And the climax then really is them getting out of the store.
Yes. Yes.
I didn't like the ending. I mean, but I understood why they did it, and I get it. I'm not going to say that bleak endings don't have a place. I'm not going to say that they should never happen.
Mm-hmm.
But like, Unfaithful is another movie that just,
ugh.
But it's like, why make it? I don't get it. Like, I don't understand what you're trying to elicit from me. I mean, I can see a movie like Hamlet or Romeo and Juliet and get a tragedy, but even that, like, tragedy occurs in these great epic films and plays. Justice is done in the tragedy. And there's a recognition of the order being restored within the tragedy.
I'm glad you brought that up because I mean, the answer to what they're trying to elicit, whether or not they're even conscious of it now, traces back to the first ideas of catharsis, right?
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
that just is what it is.
Here's the deal.
Tell me the deal.
Either you think that we all live our lives and then die and that's the end of us and death wins, or you don't think that. I mean,
sure.
Like Bill Murray says in What About Bob, there are two kinds of people in the world, people who like Neil Diamond and people who don't. And my ex-wife loved Neil Diamond is what he says. There are movies that you get sort of the feeling that their whole point is life is bleak and hard and that's the end of it.
Mm.
And there's plays like that, especially, I mean, the existentialist movement. I mean, Sartre is just like,
oh.
All right, I get it. No, but I mean, he's someone to be reckoned with. You know what I mean? Like, you got to reckon
absolutely.
With Sartre. And Beckett, you know, and it's just like, I get it. I get the quality of it. I was in Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead twice. Once is Rosencrantz, once is Guildenstern. And I love it, but it's hard for me. It's a hard play for me because the end is just like death is the end. And I remember doing that and being really affected by the fact that, frankly, I don't believe that. And so while I'm willing to explore it, acknowledge it, see other movies and plays that talk about it, stories that meditate on the idea of that, in the end, I just fundamentally don't believe it. And so there's a point at which I'm like, and so I actually think like, because I don't believe it, but because I believe that it is something that many people do buy into and that it is sort of, I would even say people who are, I mean, you and I were joking about it the other day, plenty of Christians who are like, I want to stay alive for the love of God. Like the people, like the Christians who fought to keep Terri Schiavo alive. alive, and I put that in quotation marks, and I'm not saying that insensitively. I mean, that was like this, we need to preserve life, the sanctity of life. And these are people who supposedly believe that the moment she dies, she's with God in heaven forever.
Right.
That's what they believe. And yet they're like, let's keep her here on a machine where she'll like be a vegetable forever. That's the right thing to do.
Right.
Like that. So that I know that there are people within my own faith tradition who are scared of death. And I know there are people within Christianity who really only believe what they believe because they're scared of death. I recognize that. But I think it's something that I like movies that, and this sounds so cheesy, but I think you all know me well enough. Like, I like movies that inspire hope. Like, sure. Not, but do it in authentic ways. In like, I mean, like I always talk about Fearless as my favorite movie, or Searching for Bobby Fischer, or I mean, even Pulp Fiction. Like, these inspire hope. I mean, Jules, the more I watch Pulp Fiction, the more I realize that movie's not about Vincent Vega. It's about Jules and his redemption.
Sure.
And that's amazing to me. Or you know, the other one, the most bleak movie that I probably love, I mean, or the most bleak filmmakers that I love are the Coen brothers.
Mm-hmm.
But Fargo, right? Fargo is this bleak, bleak, bleak movie. But there's this anchor of sanity and hope and a moral compass of understanding what is good and right. And there's that scene at the end where she's driving with the criminal she's got arrested in the back of the car. And she's like, and all this for just a little bit of money.
Yeah.
And then she goes, and here we are. And it's a beautiful day. And it's not a beautiful day. It's winter in Minnesota. She's like, and here we are. And it's a beautiful day. And there's this, like, even within the bleakness, there's that sense of what's that. And so, yeah, I don't hate bleakness. I don't hate bleakness. My favorite songs are sad songs,
I was going to say, that's a really important question to me. Do you listen to sad songs? And that's not... I don't ask that question in like a gotcha kind of way. I really don't.
My girlfriend in college one time, I was like, listen to this. I love this song. And she goes, of course you do. It's sad. Like all of my favorite songs are sad songs. I love the blues love the blues. I love sad music. My favorite albums are like Frank Sinatra's We Small Hours and Bob Dylan's Time Out of Mind and Blood on the Tracks, which are all just sad songs. I mean, they're all just sad songs and songs about death. I love that stuff.
But I think
weird. But movies are different than songs.
Well, I think that's for a couple reasons. I think one, just purely you are experiencing them for longer.
Yeah. You
know? So either it's
2 hours of being miserable is a lot of being miserable.
Or if it's not 2 hours of being miserable, it's a bunch of those 2 hours with hope, and then that hope is dashed.
Sure.
You know?
That's the thing. I think the moral of the story is that there's nothing to hope for. I'm like, I just don't buy your premise.
Well,
it's like a comedian that's making a joke and you think they're funny, but you don't buy any of the premise under which their jokes. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. I'm glad that you said what you just said, because I don't know that I buy your premise. I don't want to take this too far.
Go ahead.
Of talking about death, because I think the most depressing, for example... the most depressing movie that I can think of is The Deer Hunter.
Oh,
and
yeah.
There are people who die in The Deer Hunter. But that is not what makes it depressing. Those are sad moments.
Sure.
But it is the death, like the spiritual and emotional death of the people who don't physically die. That is scary. Or a completely different genre, the end of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. The girl gets away. That's not a happy ending.
But she doesn't really though, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I do think there is this like
I think it's one of the reasons I have a hard time with horror movies. The gore scares me.
A lot of them
are just like
endings.
And everybody dies,
I think that what they're trying to do, and it might be unconscious by now, or subconsciously by now, but what they're trying to do is the same thing that sad songs try to do, the same things that tragedies try to do. It's not the same because tragedy, like, how to put this? Tragedy, as you said, justice is done. It's something that is out of whack is restored to equilibrium.
Through tragedy.
Yes, through what happens to Oedipus,
the
city is saved, full stop, right? Well, actually, and his daughter, and then him again in the third play, but yes. But imagine sort of the evolution of that. Like, you're coming away from that as someone in ancient Greece, and you're like, I get it. I didn't enjoy seeing that, but right. I enjoyed the fact that everything is now right with the world. Everything's safe for democracy again, as it were.
Right, right, right.
But then people who don't quite get it or who don't think that's the most important part of it seek to elicit that feeling, right? The catharsis without the underlying religious political.
Or I think they get it and it. So here's the deal. I think they just think chaos wins in the end, that entropy and destruction wins. Sure. I think there are people who think that. And I guess what I'm saying is, from the beginning of time, when you look at the great myths of the world, not just the myths we hold dear, but the great myths of the world started in chaos, and out of chaos came order.
Yeah.
And there has always been the struggle between chaos and order. Mm-hmm. In the Bible, in the beginning, God made the heavens and the earth, and it was just darkness and void. And out of that, God said, let there be, and there became. And it was about separating and designating and creating light and dark and day and night and day and order. And you see that. And that's the myth that we're the most comfortable with. But as Jews and Christians, mm-hmm. but like I did a whole class on mythology, and you look at all the creation myths around the world, and they're all basically not the same story, but you see entropy versus
repeating things, absolutely.
And so I guess the question is, when you have people who are making there's sad songs, and I live in those because I'm sad a lot. I'm kind of a sad sack a lot of the time. I'm just kind of a bummer, but like, so I'll just sit there and listen to them and feel sorry for myself. I love that,
right?
But sad songs operate within the realm of this ain't right, not everything is terrible. Sad songs are sad because
really
I loved and I lost. Not there's no point in anything ever. There's a difference. You might feel that way within the sad song, but movies are statements. And when a filmmaker's statement basically is entropy wins, death and destruction are really what it's all about. Even if that's death and destruction of relationships,
right.
It doesn't have to be death. It could just, but the death, you know, the death of
symbolic death.
If that's their moral of their story, I'm not buying it. I'm not buying it. And that's just me personally. I'm not going to buy that product. Sure. I'm not saying they're not a right to make it. I'm not going to say it's faulty filmmaking or anything. It just ain't my. I mean, it's like Sartre, right? Sartre says hell, I mean, no exit. His whole concept for no exit is hell is other people. That's funny because I think heaven is other people.
I have another. Well, I think you're both right. Stop.
You never met my mother. Oh.
Oh. No. I have another play for you, and then I think we can put this to bed because I think we both know where the other one stands, where we both stand.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily a different place, although it is if the question is who likes the movies more. I think that's clearly me. Although I certainly don't seek them out unless there's some reason to. Like The Deer Hunter is amazing. Like The Road is amazing. Although I will never watch it again because I don't like the feeling of wanting to kill myself. Mm-hmm. But the play that I have for you is, and this is important because of our discussion of like the sort of the evolution of this feeling of the feeling of catharsis, is Death of a Salesman. And the reason that I bring up that play,
Go ahead. No, but go ahead. I know it's well made. No question.
Right. Well, what Miller did was take the everything is put back in order because there is a larger power that is in some sense out of whack, and something bad needs to happen to get it back together. But that's for ancient Greece. Mm-hmm. And yes, it's his version of America. It's his version of America.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the idea that like we're all our own men, more than you know, the birthplace of democracy in ancient Greece. We're all our own men. We control our destiny, and some people get it wrong, and that's extremely sad. But maybe what you take out of it is, I mean, God, I hope what you take out of it is I don't want to be Willie Loman, right?
Guy. Don't be that guy,
right? There are all sorts of lessons you could take from Death of a Salesman. But I think that's really interesting, and I think. If he can do that with it, and whether or not you like it, I again, you concede it's a well constructed play.
Oh,
right.
Oh yeah, unquestionably.
And so I think if that's true, it's not, and I know you're not saying this either, I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility for that to sort of splinter even further and for people to be more interested in certain aspects of that feeling, like, for example, Unfaithful, like The Deer Hunter, like the horror movie The Descent, which has two endings. I'll just say it. One in which the main character lives, one in which the main character dies, and neither of them are happy endings.
No, it's true. You know?
So
there's two things. There's one thing I want to say before we finish this up, which is two of my favorite books in the Bible are from the Old Testament, Ecclesiastes and Job. And Ecclesiastes almost didn't make it in the Bible because it was so bleak. And basically the guy says good things happen to bad things happen to good people, and that's just the way it is, and there's don't even bother trying to understand it because it's all vanity. Life is just vanity. But within that, he goes, but there's God, and God does what God does, and that's just part of the deal. I like it because at least he says, look, I don't get it, and as far as I can tell, it's meaningless, but there's a God, and that's what God chose, and so I go with it.
Right.
And I respect that. I respect that darkness because it recognizes the fact that there, like, the existence of evil or the existence of bad does not automatically just go, well, then in that case, it's all meaningless. Right. He's like, it's all meaningless, except it isn't, I guess, because there's a God. And Job, the whole moral of the story of Job is, again, bad things happen to good people sometimes, and you don't get to know why. And that is the story. But again, God's the one who says it. Like there's this whole – the climax of Job – is God shows up and goes, so you're asking me all these questions about like how this could possibly be. Where were you when I created the entire world?
Right.
Oh, you don't. Oh, you weren't there yet. So how many hairs are on a horse? You don't know that. I know that because I created horses. Right.
He does
this whole like monologue of just being like, I know why I do what I do and you don't get to know.
Right.
That's above your pay grade. Right.
Yeah.
And I respect that. And there's a lot of people who don't respect that at all. They're just like, that's a cop out. I'm like, I mean, again, if there's a God and he made everything, you don't always get to, you don't have a right to know everything.
Sure.
It's kind of funny that we just think, I think we're the first culture that just thinks we have a right to know everything. Like, and there's a lot of people who don't believe in God strictly because they're like, I don't get why it would be this way, so I don't believe in it. It's like,
okay,
I don't get why a lot of things are.
Sure.
No, but I mean, I think it's an amazingly sort of like modern American thing, like this entitlement to know all in the world. And if we can't figure it out, must be meaningless. So meaninglessness, I think I have a bigger problem with meaninglessness than I do with grim or dark.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Of course it does.
Okay.
Of course it does. I mean.
I guess so. I don't mean, when I say, does that make sense? I mean, am I being coherent? That's really what I mean. Okay.
What else would you mean by, does that make sense?
Do you agree with me? Some people say, does that make sense? And they mean, do you agree with me? Which is not the same
thing. Those people are dumb. I include myself in that because I feel like I've done that before.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know, we've all fallen short of the mark. I'll miss the mark from time to time.
Indeed.
All right. Well, that got deeper than I thought it was going to get or somethinger.
Good Lord. Yes, it's true.
I don't know if it was about movies.
Right. Remember we talked about movies? Remember we had a podcast where we talked about movies?
We shot through so many movies in the first question that I think we're fine. Like, we listed like 50 movies in the first question.
That's fair. That's fair. And all of them were the right answer. All of them were.
It's true.
Folks, this brings us to the close of another week of Second Breakfast Podcast. We hope you've enjoyed as much as we have. If you would like your question to be read on the air and answered by the extraordinary intellects you see and hear before you, email us at secondbreakfastpodcast@gmail.com. Like us on Facebook, tell your friends to do the same, and have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Andy Roth, and that's Phil Duvall. Bye.
Bye-bye.
The most important meal of the day, second